Hi, I'm Will Stein and welcome to Geography Island Jams. This podcast is in the same style as the BBC Radio 4 series Desert Island Discs, whereby in each episode I ask my interviewee what 8 songs, book and luxury item they would take with them if they are stranded on a desert island. For rights reasons, the music has not been included in this podcast. You can find links to the songs either on the Geography and Environment website or on the Geography Island Jams Spotify music account. I hope you enjoy.
Welcome to Geography Island Jams. Joining me today, I have Issam Jamaluddin. After being born in the US, Issam spent the majority of his life growing up in Limassol in Cyprus. In 2018, Issam moved to the UK to study Geography and Economics at the LSE. It's fair to say Issam really threw himself into LSE life. Whilst he studied, he was treasurer 2 years running for the Geography and Environment Society, president of the Middle East North Africa Society, danced with the LSE all-male dance group Heart Dance, sailed the LSE Marine Society, and also steered the LSE Students' Union as a student trustee. Issam is now a full-time research assistant at the Transition Pathway Initiative as part of the Grantham Research Institute on Climate Change and the Environment. Alongside this, Issam is supporting his family's business in Romania, which is where he is currently based. So welcome, live from Romania, Issam.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah, we got there in the end. I said to you just before that I initially asked Issam to come on the podcast back in March, but you know, no offense to the other guests, but I find when it's, well, I've known Issam for years, so I find the bigger the guest, the more anxious it is, the more I procrastinate with putting the questions together to make sure, obviously, I do them justice.
Yeah, no pressure.
No, but yeah, he's not only your geography and environment royal family, but you've got so many other, you know, communities and initiatives you're involved in, but we'll see. So yeah, so you've had all this time to put it together. So do you think, has that helped you choose the songs? Like, what did you struggle to get your 8 songs together?
Yeah, I have like a, you know, very varied interests and just different music genres. But I was like looking for something that were sort of old time classics, something that I can always go back to, and not something that I would just listen to for a week straight and never listen to again. So I was able to come up with my 8 choices of songs. Mm.
Yeah, it's very interesting how some people do it for, some people have deep reasons, like the song they got married to, I don't know, maybe not many students, I guess, but other people just have a sort of playlist. And then what about being able to cope on a desert island? Do you think, you know, I suppose you've lived on an island in Cyprus, not really quite something, but yeah, do you think you've got survival skills, or do you think would you enjoy being on your own?
I did DOE. That might help.
DOE, imagine island training in the DOE.
Yeah, well, I did my DOE in Cyprus. So it was a great time. I don't know if I would be able to survive. I don't have these crazy survivor skills, but I'd do my best. I think I've watched enough movies about survival.
So yeah, we're gonna kick off with the music. Can you tell me what's the first song you'll be taking with you?
So first song has to probably be Here Comes the Sun by the Beatles. It's just an absolute classic. And it's just like a feel good song. It's also a nice song to listen to when summer is about to begin. Here Comes the Sun. And summer is my favorite season, but also when my birthday is. So
double whammy.
Double whammy.
So you're born in North Carolina. I take it you didn't live there very long. You then lived in Cyprus for 20 years.
Yeah. So I was just born in the United States. And then my family was based in Cyprus. So I just grew up there and stayed there until I had to come to LSE. Mm.
And then what parts of growing up in Cyprus do you think most stand out to you? Like, what things do you think make it iconic for being a kid growing up in Cyprus?
You know, that's quite a good question, because I think that Cyprus is probably one of the best places to raise a kid or a family. And that's largely owing to how sort of relaxing the country is and how time moves quite slowly there. I guess you get to like really enjoy your life growing up. Whereas like, let's say the lifestyle in London is so fast paced and everything is sort of determined by like, you know, every minute counts, you know. I think when I first moved to London, I used to be very surprised when some people would have like a coffee meeting with me for like 15 minutes. Whereas in Cyprus, you have a coffee meeting, that's like a 1.5 hour kind of coffee meeting. And you go back and you get refills. So it's just a completely different lifestyle. You're also living right next to the beach and it's like warm all year round. And it's just, it's a comfortable place to grow up. And it's also a safe place to grow up. And, you know, maybe one day I'll move back there in like my 30s or so.
Your 30s. All fanning out. And then before your next song, do you have any favorite places in Cyprus?
Ooh, good question. I would say my favorite place may be Laçi, which is like where Blue Lagoon is. And that's just like a beautiful lagoon. Mm. I highly recommend it for anyone visiting. You can rent the boat for the day, drive around, swim in the lagoon. And it's just a great day to like spend under the sun. On any summer's day. And yeah, and then there's always some pretty crazy experiences as well in Ayia Napa, if I'm just thinking back to the older days. But
is Ayia Napa Cyprus? God, that's embarrassing, isn't it?
Yeah. Ayia Napa is in Cyprus. It's a it's the famous like cheap destination for, you know, just a fun time. cheap drinks.
Yeah, it's like a big, I suppose you could say popular form of UK destination, but I didn't put two and two together. I didn't think it was. And then, yeah, so speaking of party places, your next song you'll be taking with you.
So the next song I'm taking is Bohemian Rhapsody by Queen. Mm. And I think that this is, no really particular reason why I'm choosing this. I don't think anyone has a particular reason why they choose this song, even though it tends to be like an all-time favorite for a lot of people. But it's just like a great song. And it's probably the only song that I could enjoy for that long.
Mm. And it's quite long, isn't it? Just go on a bit, I think.
Yeah, it's like a 6 or 7 minute song. So it is very long. And, you know, I don't know many, I don't know any song, like every lyric of any song that, you know, really goes beyond 3 minutes. So this is definitely that exception.
Perfect. Yeah. So as I mentioned in the introduction, active member of the LSE community. So you were treasurer for the Geography and Environment Society for 2 years, as well as president for the Middle East North Africa Society. What would you say are the most challenging things about being committee members at LSE?
I think the most challenging thing is actually finding the time to organize events regularly. So I know, you know, Will was very talented at doing that. You always organize things very much on a weekly basis. And you made it look so easy. I can't lie, because you know, your ease in just organizing so many great events sort of made me feel overly confident about my abilities. And then once I reached that stage, I realized actually this is really difficult and you need to carve out a lot of time and you need to be able to talk to people, see what works. And it's just it's like a very feedback intensive process. And it's also challenging just to get, you know, just to get any kind of event out and running. And I think that's really the hardest thing, especially balancing it with the LSE workload.
Mm. I remember when you first told me you were going to be treasurer of geography and president of MENA, Middle East, North Africa. And I just thought, you're insane. Because like the amount, two big societies like that, it's just nuts. And then what about-
This is the first time I'm hearing your unfiltered thoughts about that.
Well, you know, you can't tell someone at the time. I really don't believe in putting people down, but I just, you know, you clearly made it work. Like you did both societies and obviously you had committees helping you and so forth, but so that was challenging. What about favorite? Do you have any favorite events or experiences from being involved in these societies?
I think my favorite event was definitely the Geography Bowl. I mean, this is just a classic, just a really great night, and, you know, quite subsidized as well for what you pay. You got like, you got a magician, you got a three course meal, you got like fireworks, and just this really amazing night that you wouldn't think that you could get in London for that kind of price. And that also that community that comes with it. You tend to, you know, I think in my experience, the Geography Bowl was where I really made some of my closest friends at university, and even met some of my flatmates too. So definitely, I would say the most important event for the geography department every year in terms of just like socializing.
Very nice. And before we go back to the music, anything you would do differently as committee life? You could go back and be committee of societies again. Is there anything you would try and do differently? Like, I suppose it might link into the first question I asked, but
I'd potentially I feel like this is like an interview question.
Well, it's quite fun. There's a reason why. It's quite interesting.
I think I'd have tried to put more of an effort in terms of engaging with all the society members during the pandemic, because the years that, or at least the year that I was the treasurer and president, so treasurer of the Geography Society and president of MENA, was also the year that the pandemic started. And I feel like I'd dropped a lot of my responsibilities just because everything was still quite raw and it was very much like a shock. And I had no idea how to run events digitally. So I wish now that I, you know, have actually experienced it and we've kind of been going through a pandemic for nearly 2 years now, I feel like I would have more experience running social events. But I feel like during that time, I kind of abandoned the society members. Although I don't know if the members were very keen on attending too many, Zoom socials. But yeah.
No, for sure. It was such a crazy time to be a society member, because as you said, it's like probably the biggest thing is balancing the time. And even, you know, it was my full-time job and I struggled. You know, I had all the time in the world to research how to do a good virtual event, and I found that really difficult. So to be, you know, do your dissertations, third year or second, all modules, and then, you know, I think, and no one in the world knew what they were doing. Like, it wasn't like it was like, hey, I'll just copy, you know, another society. Like, everyone was in the exact same boat, so there's no model which was tried and tested. Like, you know, things like the balls and the trips and so forth, it's very easy just to get a template from another department and go with it. But
yeah, there was no template to follow. That's the best way to put it.
So Fab, can you now tell me the third song you'll be taking with you?
So the third song I'll be taking is Piano Man by Billy Joel. Also, no real particular reason. It's just such a cheerful song. It's like such a classic, I don't know, pub song. And everyone will always, like, you know, raise a glass to that song.
Fab. So now I wanted to come on to, so I mentioned before you're a committee member, but you also got very involved in like various opportunities offered by other LSE societies. So you went with the Marine Society for 7 days sailing around the west coast of Scotland, and you were part of the LSE all-male dance group, Heart Dance. So what made you want to get into these originally? Had you sailed or danced before?
I could start with the sailing trip. So really the story here is that at the end of my first year, I sort of applied to the sail expedition to sail across the west coast of Scotland. And this was hosted by the SU Marine Society. And I'd seen this, it was like sort of plastered all over the hallways in St. Clement's. And I just thought, this looks really cool. You know, why not just apply for this trip? See what I've never been sailing. And really, so that's the thing. My main motivation is that I'd never operated a boat at sea or been at sea, despite living in Cyprus my entire life. So I always saw the boats. I just never went out onto one and sort of controlled one. And then there was also this like interesting focus on sort of the effects of pollution and climate change. So it really made me feel like I was going with a group of people that are sort of engaged with sort of the academic thought about, you know, what's happening to our oceans and our seas, as opposed to just going on some like party trip in Cyprus. And this was also my first time visiting Scotland. And I thought it was a pretty exciting place to, it was pretty exciting to discover a new place based on its countryside and its natural beauty, as opposed to just, you know, going straight to the city. And that said, it was like, we started off in a small village in Crinan, and then we followed the Scottish shoreline to Malig, which is another small village that had the best fish and chips in the whole UK.
Oh, wow. That's what I'm interested.
Yeah. I think all fishing towns in Scotland have pretty great just chippy shops. So yeah, and that was pretty much the whole trip. And I went with a really incredible group of people.
I was going to say, before we come onto the dance, was there anything you struggled with most? Because am I right in thinking you're on the boat for 7 days? You didn't get off. It was a 7 day straight boat trip.
Yeah. So generally, I think the tough thing was like the space. So obviously, you don't have so much space, or, you know, personal space at least, to you can't really. Let me try to rephrase that. So generally, you don't have so much space on the boat. So that just made it, sometimes you're always like in other people's business in a way. Not in a bad way, obviously, but it's just, you couldn't really be alone at any given point. But that was also like one of the fun things, that you're always around this like really kind community of people, and you were just having a great time. Although I do remember there was one very challenging day, where we sailed across like the westernmost point of like the UK mainland, and the weather broadcast that was sort of issued to all the boats in the area said that, you know, it wasn't going to be so dangerous, and you could sail around and it wouldn't be a problem. But that very day, pretty much 2 hours later, as we were getting across that peak, the waves were just so intense, and everyone on board just was throwing up, and it was just it was a really, really difficult time. Not to put anyone off of sailing, of course. We all made it, and it was an experience to remember, but I remember that as a particularly striking and challenging day.
Oh, wow. So now I think probably a little bit less throwing up, but what about dance? How did you get into heart dance?
Yeah, so with heart dance, my flatmate Dagan introduced me. Well, he was a dancer prior to us becoming flatmates, and he'd sort of been enticing me to go for like 3 months, and I'd not been part of any of the athletic unions, so just none of the sports societies, which I kind of regretted at first, because I know that those can be, you know, contrasting like societies, you know, sports societies really are like their own experience, and I hadn't really been a part of one in first year actually at all. And then in second year, I was contemplating which society I was going to join, if any. And Dagan really helped push me towards trying out dance. It was an all male dance crew, and I thought that was quite cool because it was like hip hop dancing and, you know, other genres too. So I joined and I had an amazing time. Truly was one of my more memorable experiences at LSC, just being part of that all-male dance crew.
Amazing. So now for song number four.
So my fourth song is going to be Circles by Post Malone. And this was my lockdown song. I don't know what it was about it, but the rhythm and the beat to it just was something that kind of helped relax me during the first isolation period in lockdown, where we all stayed in for 3 months. So it's still a song that I particularly enjoy to this day.
So yeah, what we've been discussing before, it seems like you're at the London School of Extracurricular, really. But apart from, all of the stuff you did on the side, you were, well, it seems like somehow still doing a degree, but I wanted to ask you about your dissertation. So you did it on how do ESG rating agencies frame climate change in their ratings. Can you just expand upon what you were looking into and what kind of things you found?
Right, yeah. So it's quite a deep dissertation, but I'll try to sort of skim through it somewhat quickly and just like, yeah, basically. Okay, so an ESG rating, so it's important to start by sort of defining what an ESG rating agency is, which is just, it's like a social, like it's an agency which issues social credit scores in a way to corporations, right? So you can give a company like a grade A on their environmental score, right? And these scores get reissued every year, usually. But then my question is like, what does that mean? Like if you're a grade A in like environment, like what does that mean? And this is very similar to credit rating agencies, which are like, what are, these are the traditional rating agencies, which have existed for decades, right? So just to look into like the credit worthiness of, you know, stocks, bonds or something, right? It tells investors whether it's something that they should put their money in or it's something that might default or so on. So in that similar capacity, they started, some companies started issuing ESG ratings to evaluate how good the social performance, the environmental performance, and the governance performance of companies were. So in that respect, I wanted to focus on environmental scores because, you know, coming from a geography degree, that's probably the, for me, that's really the most interesting thing. And I wanted to look specifically at how environmental scores sort of internalize emissions. And the motivation for that was, you know, in 2008 or 2007, 2008, we had the failure of the credit, like one of the main reasons for the global financial crisis was credit rating agencies giving out flawed ratings, you know, or just really incorrect ratings. And that sort of imperfect information ended up creating like a global financial crisis, something that we're still, some countries are still feeling the effects of to this day. So in that similar thought, I was wondering if we're handing out incorrect environmental scores, could that basically create like, you know, irreversible climate change? Like what are the effect, you know, if we're giving out incorrect ratings on, you know, stocks and bonds just for financial performance, that created a huge crisis. But what happens if we're giving these incorrect ratings to companies for environmental and like emissions related stuff? So that's like the that's the motivation. And it comes from the fact that over 70% of global emissions are attributed to the world's 100 largest companies. So the role of corporations in emissions reductions, including, you know, stakeholders engagement, this is really, really important when it comes to mitigating climate change. So the first question was, how do the world's five largest ESG rating agencies, like disclosures, frame their emissions related criteria in accordance with the goals of the Paris Agreement and the Sustainable Development Goals? So it's a qualitative dissertation, just looking at what these rating agencies are offering and how they talk about like emissions as, you know, as like one of the criteria they rate on. So the paper, my paper finds that the largest ESG rating agencies, they like have a similar way of framing emissions related criteria, and they standardize sort of in accordance with the goals of the Paris Agreement and the Sustainable Development Goals. But this standardization really varies by agency. And the variations are really talking about like, you know, each agency has very diversified services. They are, you know, they have different like indices they have, and these indices satisfy different needs of different stakeholders. And they're really just trying to sell a product, or that's often what it feels like. So for example, you have an index for retail investors, you have another one for, you know, institutional investors and so on. And the ability to satisfy all these stakeholders is a big part of it, is because of like the massive consolidation in the industry. So these traditional rating agencies, started to like absorb all these like new ESG rating agencies, which have popped up in the past 10 years. And now they just like incorporate them into like the whole bigger ecosystem. So in a way, the rating agencies, which happened to like fail massively over 10 years ago, are now the ones that are, that absorb these smaller agencies to rate climate change. And we're sort of relying on their information. So the second research question looks at, you know, how ESG rating agencies communicate the materiality of climate-related risks in their ratings. So what I mean by materiality in the broadest sense is sort of like the quality of being sort of relevant or significant. And the reason it's quite broad is because you have three types of materiality that's like sort of widely agreed upon. You have financial materiality. So in this case, that would look at, you know, it's like emphasis on climate change impacting your financial returns. But then you have environmental materiality, so which looks at how corporations are impacting and driving climate change. And then, like, you know, the EU is beginning to involve a new concept called double materiality, which is like, okay, we shouldn't focus on one or the other. That like corporations are impacting the climate, and climate is also impacting corporations and their financial performance. And there's like this kind of like cyclical impact that's going on. So this question was more fun, I'd say, because I got to go through these disclosures. I got to pick apart the language that, you know, was used by these rating agencies in their disclosures, and looking and using some like linguistic strategies, I was able to quite easily find that ESG rating agencies, at least, you know, in the disclosures from 2018 to 2021, they've really prioritized the financial materiality perspective, right? So ultimately what they were trying to, yeah, so they were just trying to emphasize the impact of climate change on financial returns. And that was how they were trying to sell the idea of their environmental ratings to like investors. Like, why you should use our data is because it will improve your financial performance, as opposed to, you know, our data will actually help save the world through your investments. Yeah, and then, but the thing is also no agency is the same with respect to sort of standardization practices or index methodological constructions or materiality conceptualization. So still every like agency differs, but it was very interesting to see that they prioritize financial materiality over anything else, even though ESG ratings are quite focused on like the ethical point of like investments.
So based off what you've looked into, are there any policies which you think need to be changed or addressed?
So I think the most important thing, or something that could truly help in this situation, is if we promote like regulatory requirements for emissions related criteria of ESG ratings. And this could really help mitigate the sort of vastly diverging methodologies which we find across agencies who simply seek to appeal to a wider audience, right? So in the same way that traditional credit rating agencies need to follow quite strictly a set of rules in terms of what they should be analyzing, in terms of like what makes a stock or a bond like credit worthy, we should do the same thing with like emissions related criteria, right? So like what makes a company, we should like set standards effectively, and, you know, allow them to innovate, allow some flexibility for these rating agencies to like innovate in the way that they give out scores. But ultimately, I think we should have like, everyone should be on the same page.
So now something a bit more lighthearted, but now we're after your fifth song.
Okay, so my fifth song is Isn't She Lovely by Stevie Wonder. It's just a fun song all around, classic by Stevie Wonder. And yeah, I can listen to it all the time. So I thought it would deserve a place on my music records on this desert island.
Fab. Well, isn't that lovely? So leading on nicely from your dissertation, you're currently a full-time research assistant at the Transition Pathway Initiative as part of the Grantham Research Institute. So what is it you're exactly doing at Grantham?
Okay, I think I'll explain what it is that the Transition Pathway Initiative does. So it's a global asset owner led initiative, which assesses companies' sort of preparedness to transition to a low carbon economy. And so this includes the analysis of like a company's management qualities, but also their carbon performance over time in across all sectors, or not all sectors, but many different sectors. And we try to keep track of sectoral alignment with the Paris Agreement, and to see, to have a good idea of whether and when sectors are going to transition to net zero emissions. So my work, so my work is really to develop a framework which aims to evaluate like financial institutions' alignment with the goals of the Paris Agreement. So really I'm looking at the, yeah, so we're focusing on like banks, investment banks, and so on, and how they spend their money. So, and just to quickly explain the motivation behind this, because at a high level, banks need to reduce their financing of fossil fuel and other activities which generate a lot of CO2. And they need to begin to increase funding of low carbon solutions to facilitate that transition to net zero emissions by 2050. And bearing in mind that banks hold a lot of capital and their investments really speak volumes. So the whole idea is to try to evaluate whether these banks and how they spend their money is aligned with the goals of the Paris Agreement, whether they have governance structures in place to mitigate climate risks. And also we like look into the quality of their disclosures and whether they should improve, you know, what they disclose to their stakeholders. So the main stakeholders of interest are international equity and fixed income investors. So really just generally all kinds of investors. And this has relevance to both private and, this has relevance to listed and private banks located all across the world. So my role in this whole thing is to develop this framework, to develop like an analyst guidance so that you can know how to score banks, to keep updating it with investors' feedback as they see the framework often and they have some ideas, we put it in and we're always updating it, trying to make it better and better. And then my job is then to analyze banks using this framework. And then after this, TPI uploads the results and then I will draft a report and which they will also upload at the end of the process.
Wow. You've got your hands full. That is for sure. What elements do you find most interesting?
I think it's really interesting to see how financial institutions view climate change, because TPI traditionally TPI has focused on other sectors. So we have a good idea of how, let's say, you know, the steel sector or electric utilities or oil and gas, how they are preparing to transition to a low carbon economy. But when it comes to financial institutions, we don't know so much. And it's very, very hard to evaluate the carbon performance of these financial institutions. So it's very interesting to see what can be done to, you know, begin to push this very, very important sector towards funding a low carbon future, as opposed to, you know, sticking with high carbon sectors and not really trying to make many changes. So in that respect, I look into, like the framework looks into like alignment with the Paris goals. So for example, we look into whether banks are like committed to net zero by 2050 with their scope 3 emissions. So that like refers to the emissions that come out of their investments, right? and whether they have clear timelines and milestones, whether they have like financing conditions, or they're using actual sector pathways and like using science to decarbonize, let's say, to help decarbonize their investments, how they're scaling up green finance, and whether they have like targets, you know, to improve some initiatives, whether the board of directors are accountable for, you know, poor climate change performance. So what we look for here is that like the bonuses of executives should be tied to the achievement of like net zero or just generally good climate change policies and not just financial performance. How are financial institutions lobbying? What are their trade association memberships? And are these aligned with the Paris Agreement? Do they have TCFD recommendations and so on? Really, it's just a long, long list, but that's just like we look for evidence that financial institutions are engaging with good practices of being, pro-environmental, and they have like we look for evidence that banks are trying to mitigate their climate impact and moving towards the right direction.
So now moving on to song number six
is Por Una Cumbeza by Carlos Gardel, and that's just a nice tango song, classical, great song to dance to.
Very nice. So we're now moving on to some of the what I like to call the wild card questions. Is there anything you think people get wrong about you? Anything which, you know, people might think of you, but yeah, they've got it all wrong.
To be honest, I don't know what people think about me. Like, it's just that it's, you know, I don't know. It's not really something that I think about too much, and nothing really comes to mind when it comes to that. But yeah, I have no idea.
Yeah, it's, you know, a good place to be, I guess, because, you know, if you think too much or people think about you, then I do think that can hold you back. I think most of the things which at least I'm happy with, I've done, you know, you can't be worried about what the rub's thinking, because especially with something new.
Yeah, agreed.
Fab. So your seventh song.
My seventh song is We Didn't Start the Fire by Billy Joel. And being a student at LSE, a lot of the events talked about in that song is things I've learned about at school. So I thought it was very interesting, you know, to start a study hard day.
So that was song number seven. So moving close to the end now. So what would you say is your, or what was, I should say, what was your favorite thing about studying at the LSE?
I'd say that my favorite thing about the LSE and my time here was probably the geography community. Like truly, truly, I feel like my experience would have been drastically different had I been part of any other department. And that's not to throw, any shade or criticism to any other department, but I've always, when I'd encounter people, I'd always see, I'd always feel like some people just didn't really feel like they were part of a community. And I couldn't quite relate to them because I always felt like in geography, we had this community and I was able to socialize with my classmates and I didn't have to, you know, I didn't necessarily have to go to different departments to meet people and to feel, feel comfortable with a group of friends. I felt like, you know, geography students are very much just an enjoyable bunch of people to hang out with. And I think that was that community, which, you know, Will, you were very much a big part of and able to facilitate. I think that's probably one of my favorite memories at LSE.
Very nice. So we're now moving on to your final song, song number eight.
So song number eight is Youth by Daughter. I think that's just like a nice song. It was a song that I heard from a game that I really liked, and I've, you know, I learned how to perform it on guitar. So I just think it's a really cool song. And yeah, I performed it in the past and I think people like it too.
Perfect. So we're now moving on to the last section. So So on the island, you are given religious text of choice, the beverage report, and a book of choice. So what is the book you'll be taking with you?
So I think the book I'd be taking with me might just be Animal Farm. I think it's a nice metaphorical, you know, very metaphorical book by George Orwell. And I think it's something that's enjoyable to reread. But obviously, you know, it's hard to pin down a choice on one specific book. So my luxury item would be a Kindle stacked with books, and I guess like geography papers too. And just having, you know, you have a Kindle, I think, you know, it really unlocks your mind in a barren isolationist place. So that would be my luxury item.
Well, I just cheat the rules a bit, but you know, I think we might be able to let it slide. So your book, Animal Farm, luxury, you would go for a Kindle. I suppose the main thing is you can't escape the island, so you can't be using that Kindle to paddle away, I should say. Assuming that passes our restrictions, what would be your, I can't remember, final meal or favorite meal?
I'd say a Lebanese mezze platter. I'm originally Lebanese, so I'm very much a big fan of Lebanese food. So this is just like a combination of just, you know, dips, salads, meats, all part of this big meal. And also I think the community that always accompanies, you know, like a nice Lebanese feast. So, you know, hummus dip, you know, tabbouleh, fattoush, you know, all kinds of meats as well. Kefta, shishtauk. So it's like meats, chickens, all kinds of things. And it's really, this all comes together as like one experience, right? It's not just about the food. It becomes part of the experience too.
You got me a hummus, to be honest. God, it's coming up to lunchtime. You just made me really hungry. That brings us to the end. Well, Issam, thank you very much for telling me about your Jogfile and Jams.
Thank you so much for having me. I had a great time.